Good morning. Greetings to each of you in the name of Jesus. It's been a pleasure to be together and to study the life of Abram. Stories about people in the Bible are always encouraging because it's not glossed over. You see the people for who they really are and the way they really did relate to God and their circumstances. And I just want to make one comment on the devotional Brother Ben had about Jesus speaking to us, or God speaking to us through Jesus, and that's better than what Abraham had. And I agree with that, because if you'll look at the number of years that went between the episodes that they had encounters with God, and you think about the fact that you can read your red letters every day of your life, it's a tremendous difference in a relationship there. But anyway, for a message, turn with me again into the book of Matthew, chapter 10. I'm going to continue with our book study. And this chapter was interesting because one of the things I like about the Gospels is most of them are written kind of in story form, but it kind of breaks out of the story format just a little bit here in Matthew chapter 10. And we have a long passage of Jesus talking to his disciples about going out to preach. And so my Bible divides the two sections. They have two headings here. The first couple verses are under the heading of Jesus sending out his disciples, and then the second part is how Jesus prepared them for persecution. We're not going to divide it that way, though. I have a couple of divisions. First of all, I want to look at Jesus' messengers. I want to look at the people that he sent. And I'm going to read this chapter, but as I read it, I want you to follow along, but also be thinking about what you know about these disciples. And then I'm going to ask you for your input on what we know about the disciples and the things I'm looking for. And I'd like the children and everybody to help on this, but things like, what did they do for occupations? Who were they related to? How did they die? What was their role in the church, and some of those things, if you can help me fill in those blanks. And we'll try to go over it so it doesn't take too much time, but I would like you to help me on those things. So let's read Matthew chapter 10 at this time. Matthew 10, verse 1. And when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these: the first, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip, and Bartholomew, Thomas, and Matthew, the publican, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Lebbeus, whose surname was Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, Go not into the way of the Gentiles, or into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. And into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and as ye go, preach, saying, The kingdom of heaven is at hand. Heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. Freely ye have received, freely give. Provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, nor scrip for your journey, neither two coats, neither shoes, nor yet staves, for the workman is worthy of his meat. And into whatsoever city or town ye shall enter, inquire who in it is worthy, and there abide till ye go thence. And when ye come into an house, salute it. And if the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it be not worthy, let your peace return to you. And whosoever shall not receive you, nor hear your words, then when ye depart out of that house or city, shake off the dust of your feet. Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. And ye shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what ye shall speak, for it shall be given you that same hour what ye shall speak. For it is not ye that speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaketh in you. And the brother shall deliver up the brother to death, and the father the child, and the children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but he that endureth to the end shall be saved. But when they persecute you in this city, flee ye into another. For verily I say unto you, ye shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come. The disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above his Lord. It is enough for the disciple that he be as his master, and the servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known. What I tell you in darkness, that speak ye in light, and what ye hear in the ear, that preach ye upon the housetops. And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, and one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore, ye are of more value than many sparrows. Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven. Think not I am come to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. He that receiveth you receiveth me, and he that receiveth me receiveth him that sent me. He that receiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive prophet's reward, and he that receiveth a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water only in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward. Again, we probably won't do justice to this chapter, but we're trying to get an overview more than specific teachings. All right, let's go back here. We're going to look at, first of all, at Jesus' messengers. Who were they? They were 12 men. We have the names of them. Let's look at the first one. What about Simon, who is called Peter? Can any of you children tell me what you know about Simon Peter? And by children, I'm thinking, 16 and down. Something like that. What do you know about Peter? What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about Peter? Maybe we should get the adults to answer some questions and make you a little less shy. Todd. Okay, occupation. It was a fisherman. Good deal. What else? Avery. Yes, we remember that too, don't we? He denied Jesus. What else do we know about Peter? Rosalie. Right. We look at his life and he seems to be impulsive. He's almost always the first one to talk. Okay. What else? Adults. Anything else? Does anybody know how he died, at least according to history? How did he die? Oh, sorry. Yes, Russell. Right. That's what we're told. That's what we read. Does anybody know what Jesus nicknamed him? Yes, Brittany. Okay. And what was special about that? He said, "Thou art Peter," and what did he finish that with? Anyone? Sure. Okay, good. It was that's what I was after, the rock. And he was going to build his church on that. All right, well, there was one other thing that I wanted to point out about Peter. He was one of what I'm going to call the inner circle. Who else made up the inner circle? We'll get to these later, but just name them for me right now. You know what I'm talking about. Right, Peter, James, and John. We often think of us three together. That's the people that Jesus seemed to Maybe they were the ones that were the most dangerous, so you had to keep a close watch on them. I don't know. But anyway, all right, so we have that about Peter. There's probably more. Peter's one of the ones, you look through the book of Acts, who was the first one to talk there? It was Peter. So we have this negative thing sometimes coming out to be a positive thing at another time. Okay, Andrew. What do we know about Andrew? If I don't see your hand, just say it. What was his occupation? Yes. Right, he was also a fisherman. Do we know who he was related to? The Bible's pretty clear on that, isn't it? He was a brother to Peter, right? There was something special about Andrew. I think I have this right. Go ahead.
He's a people person. He's a
person. Yes. Sure. I wanted to hear that. Thank you. I should have verified this maybe, but I believe he was also a disciple or an apostle, a disciple of John the Baptist, and John the Baptist pointed him to Jesus. I'm not mistaken on that. Does anybody know what tradition says was his death? Anybody? This one surprised me. Supposedly, he was hung on an X-shaped cross, and it took him 2 days to die. Now, that is commitment to somebody. That's amazing.
That's the cross that
shows
up on the British flag.
Is that what it is?
St. Andrew's cross.
Okay. I didn't. That's a new one for me. Thank you. What do we know about James, the next one in line? It says he's the son of Zebedee. We know that. What else do we know about him? Just some things. Yes, Jero. Okay. He was killed with a sword. Do you know who killed him? Or who had him killed? Herod. That's right, Herod. And if you remember that story... This is going to take too long, but anyway, this is interesting. If you remember that story about James, whenever Herod saw that it made the Jews happy, what did he do? He put Peter in jail, right? He was ready to take another one out, but then Peter escaped. All right. What is a nickname for James? What do we have for a nickname for James? Yes. Okay. He and John were known as the Sons of Thunder. That's why I said maybe he and... Peter and John were the most dangerous. Maybe they were a little rash, and Jesus needed to keep them close so that he could keep a watch on them. Just a suggestion. I don't know. Okay. Does anybody know what his occupation was? Do we know?
Fisherman.
Probably a fisherman. I don't know if it actually says, but I believe he was. It would make the most sense anyway. His father was a fisherman. All right. What about John? What do we know about John? We know a lot about John, don't we? Do you have your hand up, Brittany? Okay, brother to James. Had the same nickname, same father. What else? Just anything that comes to your mind. I have a list here that I'm consulting, but there's probably things that are not on my list that you could talk about. Okay, you think of Isle of Patmos, right? And tradition says that he died there, the only one to die of old age. What was his nickname other than the Son of Thunder? He was also known as the disciple whom Jesus loved, right? And there's one other little trivia here that I picked up that probably take too long to try to get a guess. But anyway, I found it interesting to realize that he wrote 5 books in the Bible. That's
pretty amazing. 5 books. Now, some of them are short, but still. Okay, what about Philip? What do we know about Philip anyway? Some of these are really just not much there. But what do you think of when you think of Philip? Okay, is that the same Philip? I was thinking it was a different man. Okay. I don't know. Maybe somebody can help us out on that. Is that the same person? Any of you Bible scholars know? I was thinking it was a different person, but it might have been the same man. We'll just say that it was for now. I should have verified that more. There's something I want, though, and it's probably a little obscure. But Philip was the man who introduced Bartholomew to Jesus. And that tells me something about Philip. It means to me that Philip was looking for Jesus, because his words when he went to Nathanael, or Bartholomew and Nathanael is the same person. When he went to them, he said, "We have found him." And he comes from Nazareth. And then, well, that takes us to Bartholomew. What did Bartholomew say whenever Philip said that? Does anybody know? Any of you children? Young people, "We have found him." And Nathanael comes back and says, any of you adults, just say it for me. "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Now, what did Jesus say to Nathanael whenever he met him, or Bartholomew? It's the same person. What was Jesus' commendation to him? I would love if Jesus could say this to me. Yes. Okay, there is no guile in him. That is amazing. We don't have any record for sure of how Philip or Bartholomew died, but we do believe, according to what people write, that they were both martyred. Let's move on to Thomas. What do we know most about Thomas? What do you think of first? Any of you children, what do you think of Thomas? What did he do? Jarrell. Okay, we have that doubting. He didn't believe. But when Jesus showed up, what did he do? What did Jesus tell him to do? I don't know if he did it or not. Yes. Right, Jesus told him to touch him. I don't know what crucified hands look like, but I don't think I'd want to touch him. I don't know if Thomas did or not. It is believed that he went on to die a martyr's death. We don't know much else about Thomas. It takes us to Matthew. What do we know about Matthew? Do we know his occupation? Okay, publican, tax collector. It's interesting that he wrote this gospel and he always refers to himself as Matthew the publican. It's like he couldn't believe that Jesus would have time for a publican. And he was always amazed. It seems to me, that's what John was expressing when he would say, "the disciple whom Jesus loved." It was like, can Jesus love me? But he did. Anyway, now, the other thing that impresses me about Matthew, did he take his tax collection occupation with him? No, he was like the fisherman. He just left it. I'm assuming he could make a lot of money being a tax collector. That's kind of the rap they get, the reputation. I don't know if they actually did make out as well or not. And of course, we are studying his gospel. Do we know anything about James, the son of Alphaeus? I couldn't find much at all, if anything, really, other than that he was the son of Alphaeus. But do y'all have any? There's quite a lot of scholars out here. What do we know about James? Sometimes he's called James the Less. I guess because of the lesser reputation. Okay, I don't have anything that I can prove from Scripture about him. What about Lebius or Thaddeus, or sometimes even known as Judas? I'm not sure why some of these men have so many names, but We don't know much about him. There's a possibility that he was the man who wrote the book of Jude, but there's also some scholars that say otherwise. So in my study, I really don't know if he wrote the book of Jude or if Jude was written by Jude, the brother of Jesus. The 11th disciple listed here is Simon the Canaanite. Now, he's also known as Simon the Zealot. And from this, we don't really know much other than he was probably part of some political party hoping that Jesus would be the one to lead the rebellion against the Romans. The Zealots were a group of people like that. And some of this is a little vague. That's why we're just moving on. But we don't really know much about him. Now, what are the things that come to your mind when you think of poor Judas Iscariot? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? Anybody? Jarrell. Right, we think of his betrayal. That's the first thing we think of. What are some other things that we think of when we think of Judas? Harold. He committed suicide, right. That's another thing that I had on my list. What else? Right, he was a greedy thief. He would take money. I believe that he was the one who complained about the lady dumping the perfume. Poor Judas. Do we know anything positive about him? He was one of the 12. That is right. It is amazing to me that Jesus sent Judas out on this mission with the rest of them. But he did. There's a lot of lessons we can learn about these 12, but we'll get to that. I'm going to try to conclude this message with lessons that we can learn. Thank you for your input. That was enjoyable. I'm sure there's more that we could look at with these 12 men, but these make up the 12 men that Jesus chose. Now, Jesus had many disciples, many of them, but these were the 12. They made up the little, what we would call, I guess, the elite, and then there was another core group inside that, which would have been Peter, James, and John, that he really seemed to relate well to. Or maybe they related well to him. I'm not sure how to put that. But anyway, let's look now at what Jesus sent them to do. He sent them out to do something, and this takes me to the second part of the message. What was their job? In verses 5 through 8, he assigns them a message and a task. The message is the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and the tasks given were to heal the sick, to cleanse the lepers, raise the dead, cast out devils. And he tacks on this thing here. He says, freely ye have received, freely give. And so we have this idea of the kingdom of heaven. The other thing I want you to notice is that they were supposed to go to the house of Israel first. They were not supposed to go to the Gentiles. They were not supposed to go to the Samaritans. And there's probably many reasons for that. But Israel was God's people. And he wanted to make sure that they got their share of Jesus. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but you remember the story about the lady that came and said, I would like my daughter to be healed. And he said, it's not good for me to give the food that's meant for the children to the dogs. So you see that thing happening there, but later in the book of Acts and even through the Gospels, you'll see that Gentiles definitely were welcome. So we don't need to feel bad about that this morning, but it brings something to us that people that have high privileges also have high responsibilities. They had the responsibility and the privilege of receiving the gospel of the kingdom firsthand. And I think that's why when we get down here to verse 15, we have these startling words that if those people don't listen, it's going to be better for them. It's going to be better for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for the people that reject you. That is serious words from the mouth of Lord Jesus Christ. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that the kingdom of heaven was offered to the house of Israel first before it was offered to anywhere else. And we see later in the book of Matthew, when the Jews were obviously rejecting it on a large scale, that Jesus said, the kingdom's been taken from you and given to another. But part of that job is to go and to do good, to preach the gospel of the kingdom, and then to help people. Now, in verses 9 through 13, we have these instructions. What were they supposed to do? They were given some instructions of how to act. First of all, he says, make sure you don't take anything with you. Now, obviously, they had to take some things with them, but Jesus is specifying that there should be nothing extra. I came across this thought in my studies. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's interesting. Whenever you read here, provide neither gold nor silver nor brass in your purses, it sounds like they were supposed to go around begging their living off of everybody else and expecting that to carry them through. And maybe that's true. It does seem like in this way of reading it, it would make the most sense. However, there was this other idea that this was not so much about having money to pay for their way. It was receiving money for the things that they did. Now, that does put a little spin on it, and especially I like that little twist because of verse 8. When Jesus says, freely ye have received, freely give, what Jesus did not want is for his gospel of the kingdom to become a marketing scam. That they would go out and say, you know what, I can fix you, I have that power to do that, but I'm going to make you pay. It totally destroys the whole core of the gospel. The gospel is supposed to be free, and I think I just want to bring that in there as maybe an additional instruction there that the disciples would have heard. They obviously had some things. They had at least one coat. They had at least one pair of shoes. They had at least one stick or walking staff. Obviously, they had to rely on people for their food and for their lodging. But it seems like Jesus was definitely making sure they understood that the gospel was to be free. The other thing that they were supposed to do is use the goodness of the people in the town or the city where they went as an indication of whether they were worthy to hear the gospel. And this is an interesting concept, because he said, you go there and you find out who's worthy, and then you go there, and if they accept you, then that's wonderful. You stay there. If they don't, then you're supposed to shake off the dust of your feet. And I believe that the person that was worthy was the one who was willing to host the apostles, to give them the food and the lodging that they would need, and a refusal to listen to the disciples would have been a judgment against them. Now, this thing of shaking the dust off their feet, this was a Jewish custom when leaving a Gentile region. They were so dedicated to keeping themselves separate from Gentiles that they would try to get all the dirt of a Gentile region off their feet. Now, can you imagine what this would have meant to a Jew that would have refused to hear the disciples, and the disciples bend down and take off their sandals and shake out the dust? That would have meant something to them that it doesn't really register. We don't even do that, so it doesn't really carry much significance with us, but try to put yourself there and imagine what that would be. And then Jesus goes on and says, after you shake that off of your feet, and then he makes the comment that it would be better to be in the shoes of Sodom and Gomorrah than that city in Judgment Day. Very strong words. Now, moving on, one of the other things Jesus did in this discourse was tried to help his disciples get ready for persecution. In verse 17, he says, verse 16, he says, I'm going to send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. What a strange picture. Helpless sheep in the middle of wolves that are ready to eat sheep. And he warned them, that's what's going to happen. And then he uses some more similes. Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And basically use your head and don't hurt anybody. But he says in verse 17, there's going to be people that are going to persecute you, and they're going to come from your own religious group. There's going to be people in your own religion that are going to haul you in, and they will scourge you, and they will hate you, even though they are your friends or they're the same Jewish religion. Another group of people that he tried to prepare them to face in verses 18 through 20 is the governors and the kings. We have the governments hating these people as well. And he says in verse 19 that they're going to take you there, but you're not supposed to try to plan your speeches. You're supposed to just rely on the word that I will give you. It's an act of faith to be hauled in before a government. And we can see that these disciples did do that. They had their chances, or their times, I should say, not chances, of being faced with angry governments, and they were able to speak. Apostle Paul, he wasn't one of these 12, but later he was so used so powerfully in front of kings and governors that one of them even said, you know what, you almost persuaded me to be a Christian. And so if Paul would have tried to prepare that speech, I wonder how it would have gone. But no, he was relying on the Spirit of God to give him the words that he needed. Another group that is even more heartbreaking than your own religious group that will persecute, Jesus says that it will be brothers against brothers, fathers against children, and children against parents. There will be persecution within families, and be ready for that. And very, very sad to think about that, but it is part of what Jesus warns against. So we have this warning. Jesus says, this is what's going to happen. I want you to go out there. I want you to rely on the goodness of the people that you meet, but also be ready for meeting some wolves, and they will do their best to hurt you. This is all part of this missionary program that's going on. Now, Jesus clarifies some things in verses 22 all the way to 39. I won't pick out all these verses, but I want you to just look at that block of verses there. Jesus, in my mind, what he's doing so far, he's saying, this is what's going to happen. This is how I want you to act. This is what you can expect. And then verse 22, he kind of goes into an explanation of all of this. And I think what he's doing is trying to summarize and bring together the tension that exists between the spiritual and the physical and the temporal and the eternal. And he says, you're going to have to decide what you want to do with this. And so let's look at what he says. First of all, he says in verse 22, you're going to be hated for my name's sake, but you, if you endure to the end, we heard about that in Sunday school, that enduring to the end. It's only those that endure to the end that will be saved. He told us, he said, you need to expect persecution. He's telling his disciples this, and I believe these words are for us today. We need to expect that there will be people that don't like us. Now, one of the things that I find interesting is this. In verse 23, he says, if you are persecuted in one city, you're supposed to go to the next city. And I think that's a lesson for us. I think it was a lesson for them. There's a sense in which we can say, please, God, persecute us. But it isn't really the case. God doesn't really want his people to be killed. I think I'm safe in saying that. Timothy tells us, Paul in Timothy tells us that we're supposed to pray for peace. And so I think we need to be careful with this thought that persecution is supposed to be this wonderful purging of the church. It would purge the church, okay? It would. But I think we need to be careful about this thing wishing that we would get persecuted so that we could purge the church. It's a very dangerous thing to think about. Jesus specifically says that you can expect persecution, but you don't need to go out looking for it. And when it happens, you need to try to get away from it. And that's part of what brought us to America. If our forefathers didn't see that, they left. They came over here. That's part of what spread the gospel from Jerusalem. Whenever the persecution got intense, you read through the book of Acts, they fled. They went all out into all kinds of areas of the world. And so the gospel got spread. So let's be careful with that concept. But anyway, I think what we're learning here is that we are not to just blindly accept persecution. as the will of God. There's a chance that it'll happen. Sometimes it does. We have people that we know of that are suffering persecution, and I'm not saying that they did something wrong, that they are persecuted. I hope you understand what I'm saying. But if we can, we should be not just blindly looking for persecution. The next concept that Jesus teaches here is that disciples are to be as their master. In other words, the acid test, the reality of whether we're a disciple or not, is whether or not we act like our master. I like the way one brother put it. He said, can you be a follower of Christ without following Christ? And that's what Jesus is saying here. That if we're going to be disciples, we need to expect, first of all, to follow him, and then second of all, to be treated like him. He says if they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, what are they going to call the people of his household? The next concept that Jesus is teaching here is that his message was given to a relative few people in verses 26 through 27. Now, he says that things that are covered and things that are hid. And Jesus also said at another place that he didn't do anything in secret. And so I'm trying to balance all of this in my mind. But what it seems like he's saying is that my message has been given to a relative few. But I'm giving this message to you, and you're supposed to take it. What does he say in verse 27? Whatever I tell you in darkness, you're supposed to take out and preach. Whatever you hear in your ear as a secret, you're supposed to broadcast it on the housetops. So we have this idea here that Jesus wants us to be, or he wants his disciples to be the carriers of his message. I'm sure you've heard of these little sayings that, you know, Jesus didn't write any books, but more books have been written about him than any other person. He never wrote a song, but more songs have been written. That's kind of the idea that we have here. Jesus himself spoke these words, but then the men were the ones that recorded it and preached it. And it's their job to do that. Jesus wanted that to happen. I'm going to skip down to verse 37. Another thing, we're going to come back to some of these other things in verses 29 and on a little later. But another thing Jesus is teaching is in this tension, in this battle between spiritual and physical, we need to be ready. And sometimes we need to be more than ready. Sometimes we actually have to give up physical things that make a lot of sense in order to serve Jesus. And what he means by that is when I have even a family member, even one of my children that becomes more precious to me than my soul or my relationship with Jesus Christ, Jesus says, you're not worthy of me. When we seek to find our lives, what he's saying there, I believe, is when we try to secure our life by whatever means, by health insurance, by big bank accounts, by you name it, you fill in the blank. What do people turn to for security? iPhones, whatever. Whenever we're trying to find our lives, he assures us that those things will be lost. But when we're ready to lose those things and to give up earthly securities, we actually find our life with him in a real way. But it may mean some costs on the earthly end. And it goes back to this thing of faith. I enjoyed the Sunday school lesson so much because of I knew what I was going to share here this morning. But you think about Abraham, he only ever saw one son of promise. He never saw more than that. He might have seen his grandsons. And he had other children to Keturah, but God told him that this is the son. It's going to be born, it's going to be Sarah's son. And he never really got to see much of that. And we say, well, that was Abraham, and we don't have that kind of thing today. Yes, actually we do. Jesus gave us many promises about what we can gain through following him. But he says, you're going to have to give up some of these things in order to gain these. And so we still have this act of faith that we're going to have to step away from what looks like makes so much sense and to do something that 99% of the other people aren't doing. Finally, Jesus teaches that when we do these things, there will be a reward. And we just studied all morning in Sunday school about promises. When God makes a promise, he is well able to keep it. We don't need to worry about that. Okay. Now, I have been kind of weaving some practical things that we can learn throughout these comments. But now I want to just go back through, look at these things, and just kind of pull it all together. Lessons that we can learn from Matthew chapter 10. As we look over this chapter, there's many, many things that we could talk about. I just want to pick out some things and leave you to go home and think about them more if you care to. Back to his disciples. We talked about his disciples. We talked about their humanity. We talked about their occupations. We talked about how Jesus related to them. We talked about whether we knew much about them or not. And from that, I can conclude this, that Jesus' disciples come from all levels of intellect, reputation, character, faith, occupation, and strengths and weaknesses. They come from all levels. There is no need for us to be gauging whether a person is worthy to be his disciple. Jesus relates and loves all men. Jesus even loved Judas. In John 13, I believe it says that he loved them to the end. He knew when Judas walked out of there what he was about to do. He knew that Judas wasn't trustworthy with the bag, but he gave him the bag anyway. Jesus let himself be robbed. What a senseless thing to do. But Jesus' disciples teach us something about the way Jesus relates to people. Jesus loved Peter. Even as he stood up there and knew that Peter was in the hall denying him, he knew that. He loved all of his disciples, even though they scrapped around about who was going to be the greatest. He loved them when they wanted to call down fire on people that he loved. He loved those people too. He loved them when they deserted him at his arrest. From Jesus' disciples, we learn that Jesus loves people. And imperfect people at that. The second thing I want to point out here is that the kingdom of heaven is not a myth. It is not strictly for the future. Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is at hand. If it was at hand in his day, it's at hand in our day as well. It is here. I am not here to deny that perhaps there will be a fuller revelation and fulfillment of this kingdom. Possibly there will be. Hopefully there will be. But there is a work of the kingdom that we are asked to do today, and that is to do good, to love our enemies, to bless them with whatever we can. Now, I don't believe that we're expected to have the power to go out and heal the sick and cleanse lepers, but this injunction of freely ye have received, freely give, what do we possess here this morning at Darby Mennonite Church that we should be giving? And I'm not talking just about money. That's the easiest and probably the worst thing to give people. But we have a wealth of community. We have a wealth of love. We have a wealth of what else? What makes your life a good life living in this Christian community? And how can we take that and give it to other people? To me, that is the kingdom of God right now. And it's something we need to be busy with. We should be able to do these things without asking for payment. Going into these verses about persecution, what can we learn about it? I've been talking a little bit about how we shouldn't be asking for persecution. One of the things that I will point out, though, any study of history, of church history, of Christian history, will indicate to us that we have lived in unusual times for the past number of years, and I don't know how long. It depends on what you call persecution, I guess, but even in this country, you go back far enough, and there was issues with drafting, and during the Civil War, the Mennonites would have faced some of those problems of soldiers coming through and burning stuff and taking stuff, and the Revolutionary War was also one that created a little bit of hard times, and even later than that, or closer to our time, World War I. Now, the church was more ready for World War II, and the government seemed to be more ready for World War II. Since then, we have experienced a level of peace and prosperity that is, I dare say, unprecedented in history. And I should praise the Lord. However, it is during times like this that it seems as though we forget what is spiritual and what is eternal, and we focus a lot on temporal things because it's so easy. Why not make $1 million? That makes sense. We should do that. The other thing that we have going for us, I mentioned it in the last point, I want to mention it again, we have a wealth of blessings in our Anabaptist Christian circles that what are we doing with it? And I'm talking about just the ability to trust each other. And it goes beyond just our church here. It goes all over the place. If I got a call from somebody from, we do it all the time. We host people in our houses. We hardly know them, but we know that they're probably trustworthy people because they go to a similar church. They live in a similar community. The wealth of that is, it's partly because of where we live and how we live. Anyway, what does this have to do with persecution? Well, it doesn't actually have that much to do with persecution, except that because we aren't persecuted, we have been tremendously blessed. But at the same time, it's almost a double-edged sword because it seems like it's in times like this that we have more people giving up and they stumble at things that seem to be so little. And so for you young people, I want you to think about, and old people too, it's a temptation for older people. If you're ever tempted to just give up and say, it's not possible to be faithful, and if you can't do it now, you'll never do it if persecution comes. I don't know if that's too strong or not. But don't let the hypocrisy of some other church member make you stumble and give up. Don't let your parents' imperfections make you think that they can't be trusted. Don't let the inconsistencies of church standards sometimes make you think that all is lost. Think about what you would lose in the attempt to gain something else. Now, it is to be expected. It seems to be the normal pattern of things, though, for the followers of Jesus to sit cross-culturally and to irritate some people at some point. Moving on, verse 23. I said this already. I'm just going to say it again very quickly. There is no responsibility to antagonize people with the gospel. We are to share the gospel. We're to help them. We're to do good to them. We're to love them, but there is no call on us to go around and make people angry with the gospel. The gospel will do that of itself. It's the truth that makes them angry, not the people. Another point, verses 26 through 28. This is true for all times, whether we're in persecution or not, but the fear of man often exceeds the fear of God. It's a lesson we can learn. I don't know why that is, but for some reason, y'all scare me way worse than God does. I will do things sometimes just to make sure y'all are happy. And I don't really think very much about what God thinks about it. Is that okay to say? If I were to ask you to raise your hand, I wonder if you would agree with that statement. But there's really something messed up in that view, because men aren't satisfied until they run your life ragged. And if I get one of y'all satisfied, the next one's not satisfied. The fear of man is what drives people to depression and suicide and drink and drugs. Let's stop it. We need to respect each other. We need to love each other. We need to try hard not to hurt each other's feelings. But at the end of the day, God is the one that we need to fear. Another thing, right on top of fearing God, I want you to think about what kind of God we serve. Look at verses 29 through 31. Yes, we are to fear God because he has the power to destroy both soul and body in hell. But another thing that's different about God, when I fear men, they are using me to their ends and to their advantages. When I fear God, I am serving a God that actually watches sparrows fall. And he cares about a little dinky bird. You boys, when you shoot sparrows, I want you to think about it. Don't waste life, because God sees those little sparrows, every single one of them that falls. Somehow, I wish we could grasp that. We need to fear God, yes, but what kind of God are we fearing? We're fearing the kind of God that really cares about our souls. We're fearing the kind of God that actually, I believe, while he is angry with the wicked, he even grieves over the wicked in his anger. Somehow that needs to fit together. It just needs to, because God knows everything. He knows how many hairs are on our head, and he will watch over us. Okay. Verse 32 and 33. Confessing Jesus openly before men versus denying Jesus. Much could be said about this, but I do know this, that it's much, much harder to confess Jesus with our lives than it is to deny him. And that's one reason all of us needs to surround ourselves with good friends, friends that will help us to confess Jesus, not make it difficult, so that when we find ourselves in a situation where it would be really easy to deny Christ, we have the support of good people saying, you know what, it's not worth it. It's possible to be faithful without friends, but barely. In verses 34 through 36, Jesus says that he's come to send a sword, not peace. But if you go back to the prophecies of Jesus, he said that he's called the Prince of Peace. He asks us to be peacemakers. He says, blessed are the peacemakers. So what do we do with this? Well, I think it goes back. This is the way I wrote it. I think this is like the Bible. The Bible is comforting to people, right? We read the Bible and it's comforting. It brings peace. But the Bible is also called a sword. And I think that what Jesus is teaching us here is that he, the person of Jesus, the man of Jesus, is the embodiment of truth. And truth never has a foot on one side of on either sides of the fence. There is only two sides, and you're either on truth side or you're on error side. And that's what Jesus is saying here, that there's no way to have it both ways. You can't do it. And so, obviously, when you have truth saying this is the line and error saying, oh, you don't have to say that, there's going to be antagonism. And while we don't face persecution, we face this a lot. Maybe it's not persecution, but we see it more in the cold shoulder type thing. You disagree with your neighbors on something about voting or whatever it is, or you try to talk to them about some of Jesus' demands about especially morality and divorce and all those kind of things. And it doesn't take long to get division there. It's just a blessing that you can have a group this size that gets along as well as it does. But every time truth comes up and you have to make a decision, it's a sword because it will divide. And I think that's what Jesus was saying there. But for those that are living in truth, there's no greater peace. What can the world give us that equals that? What will error give us? Anyway, I'm taking too long. Two more points. Verses 37 through 39, the lesson we can learn here. When we are faced with a decision about losing earthly things or heavenly things, we will always lose when we choose earthly. We have a certain amount of earthly things. The disciples were sent out with a certain amount of earthly things. They had at least one coat, at least one pair of shoes. They had some things. But if it ever gets to the place where I know that God is leading me to a point where I have to give up one thing at the expense of the other, if we pick the earthly at the expense of the spiritual, we will lose every time. Now, the last point, verses 40 through 42, we have all of these promises about rewards. Verse 39 even promises life. Now, I don't know, and I'm not really going to try to explain what all of these rewards are. But I'm pretty sure that all of us will be happy with any of them. Because God is that kind of God. And He will reward us. It's a promise. We can rest on that. And when it comes to that choice that I was talking about between the earthly and the heavenly, and we decide to discard the earthly because we want to gain the heavenly, I promise you on the authority of this that God is a good God and that you will not be sorry with the heavenly reward.